is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So we're looking deep down into sort of behavioral change, and when we do this, we don't only talk to men, we talk to boys, and we talk to young boys, so boys as young as 6 and 7.
That's Sahlen Gaja-Dahar, South African government spokesman on efforts to change male attitudes to lessen the problem of gender-based violence. Details coming up also. The Ethiopian government says the U.S. is spreading false information about security conditions in the country. And an Egyptian court sentences 22 Islamist militants to death. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia have claimed responsibility for a suicide attack on a UN convoy in the capital Mogadishu today during morning rush hour that killed at least 8 people and wounded 17. Mohamed Kayi reports for Mogadishu.
Al-Shabaab's spokesman told Reuters news agency the suicide car bombing Thursday was aimed at UN security convoy. It was not immediately clear if any UN staff were among the casualties, but Somali police spokesman Abdulfatah Aden Hassan confirmed the UN convoy was the target. Hassan told state media Radio Mogadishu that the attack was near several schools. The Associated Press reported several students among the victims. Hassan said they were limited as schools were already on weekend break. He says most casualties were small business owners and passerby in the area, since there were no lessons for students today. At least one school appeared damaged by the blast, with social media images showing a blown-out classroom and debris scattered across the desks. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu strongly condemned the attack in a tweet, saying the people of Somalia deserve to live without fear of attack. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab carries out frequent attacks in Somalia with aim of overthrowing the government. Mohamed Kayi for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
South Africa, like many countries once struggling to get COVID-19 vaccines, is now stuck with an oversupply. Its health department is now asking pharmaceutical companies to delay deliveries of jabs as it tries to clear stock on hand. The continent's second largest economy is the African nation's worst hit by the pandemic, recording almost 3 million infections and 90,000 deaths. Darren Taylor reports.
A fourth wave looms, but the health department's battling to get needles into arms.
The vaccination numbers have slowed down, and it's concerning that it's slowed so much.
Health Director General Dr. Nicholas Crisp is coordinating South Africa's vaccine rollout. He says it's averaged 106,000 doses a day over the past 2 weeks.
We should be by now over 250,000 a day. We have vaccine, we have the capability of vaccinating, we have a lot of people who need to be vaccinated, we've got a lot of different initiatives that are targeting outreach clinics, mass vaccination sites, private vaccinations in pharmacies and other sites. There are a lot of public clinics that are vaccinating, but they are all reporting that they are not full and they could be seeing a lot more people.
Department officials told VOA that South Africa has almost 17 million doses in stock. Only 35% of citizens are fully vaccinated. Crisp says several factors are hampering efforts to immunize 60% of a population of 60 million before the end of the year.
It's complicated, and part of it is that we lost a bit of momentum in the week that we didn't have vaccine at all clinics, and it was a little bit difficult for people to get to sites, or a bit irritating for them to get to sites and then be turned away. So the public were frustrated during that week. I think that's part of it. The other is that there's a bit of vaccination fatigue. You know, we're out of the third wave in parts of the country and people have relaxed their guard a bit. I think also that there is some hesitancy. People wait and see. There's a lot of noise by anti-vaxxers who can't see the obvious evidence that vaccinations save lives.
South Africa has a small but vociferous anti-vaxxer group that's spreading disinformation and lies, says Crisp, that the jabs are dangerous and even kill people.
And it seems that it's definitely less than 10% of the adult public who are what we would regard as anti-vaxxers, people who are dead against vaccination for either religious or other reasons. That means the remaining 90% are either hesitant, listening and wondering what's going to happen and watching and waiting and seeing, or they are highly committed and have already been vaccinated.
His department's launched a mass communication campaign to recruit more people to the cause, as he puts it.
So we would like to appeal to the public, look at the facts, consider the testimonies of the many people who are telling us about their personal experiences in hospital and of friends and family of theirs who were not vaccinated, who got into serious trouble and or died. We know that vaccines save lives. We are very clear that there's sufficient data on that. We also know that vaccines are like any other vaccine, do have side effects, and we do know that adverse events are reported. But the numbers of adverse events that happen are minute compared with the complications that we are seeing from COVID infection.
Crisp says proof of the efficacy of the vaccines lies in the fact that not a single healthcare worker who were the first to get jabs in February has died of COVID-19 since then, and very few have fallen seriously ill with the disease. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa has launched its 16 days of activism for no violence against women and children campaign. Vicky Stark reports on the event that is part of an annual global effort.
It'll take years for men's behavior to change, but campaigns like these raise awareness about just how dire the situation is in South Africa. That's according to Shailen Gajada, spokesperson for Minister in the Presidency for Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities, Maiten Koane Mashabane. Her department says police stats show that over 9,500 rape cases were reported from July to September. It says a sample of 6,144 of these cases showed that 3,951 took place at the home of the victim or the rapist. Gajada adds that the femicide rate at about 10 per 100,000 is also unacceptably high.
It is a UN campaign observed from the 25th of November to the 10th of December every year globally. In South Africa, it's very important because South Africa has a particular history, and this history is wound in gender inequality. And with that, we have seen levels as high as 5 times the global average when it comes to gender-based violence and femicide.
He says government, civil society, and faith-based organizations have joined hands to try to bring the numbers down.
So we're looking deep down into sort of behavioral change. And when we do this, we don't only talk to men, we talk to boys and we talk to young boys, so boys as young as 6 and 7. So part of the programs that government has passed, which looks at sexuality education and sexual and reproductive health and rights, you know, part of that is addressing sort of gender dynamics and addressing men understanding how to express their sexuality without, you know, without encroaching on or violating the rights of women.
He gives more detail on what the programs entail.
Looks at addressing patriarchal attitudes, looks at addressing this idea of masculinity, which is deeply entrenched within cultures in the country, looks at addressing a sort of culture of bystanderism, so where boys and men are willing to look away or by remaining indifferent, support actions that are microsites for violence. So here I'm talking about bullying, I'm talking about harassment on the street, I'm talking about catcalling, I'm talking about physical grabbing of women within social settings that sort of consider that to be justifiable in some ways.
Gajada says the National Council on Gender-Based Violence is in the legislative pipeline with representatives from civil society and government. He says it will be able to measure response to programs and other interventions.
And to be able to point and push and poke in the right areas, to be able to ensure that our response is a sustained response outside of the 16 days of activism, but, you know, 365 days of the year, and to hold those accounts. And that's why I want to use the word of accountability, because that's the theme for this year, you know, the movement from awareness to accountability, to hold those responsible for doing something, you know, accountable. So whether that's government, civil society, or individual men who need to be held responsible for their actions, the term of accountability is where we want to lay our energy.
Gajadhar says it's likely the president will chair the council. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
Uganda, like some other African countries, is grappling with a surge in cases of female genital mutilation during the COVID-19 pandemic. Reports from the Ministry of Gender, Labor and Social Development indicate that the numbers have shot up from 0.3% of women, where they had stagnated for more than 5 years prior to the global pandemic. However, during the pandemic, records from health facilities show that the practice has increased by 56%. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For over a decade after outlawing female genital mutilation, FGM, Uganda has tried to keep the practice at bay. However, the COVID-19-induced lockdown has kept girls out of school since March 2020. Among the FGM-practicing communities in eastern and northern Uganda, the girls are being forcefully mutilated in the night and in the bush. Moses Logwe is a village secretary in one of those communities. He told VOA that schools are the safest place to protect children against harmful practices, including FGM.
Nowadays, they identify a day where all girls are collected at that age where they are supposed to be cut. When it is done indoors after COVID, it is too rampant, very common. I don't know whether now how many girls will survive.
The FGM ritual is an initiation of girls between 15 to 19 years into adulthood. Peace Mutuzo, the Minister of State for Children and Cultural Affairs, told VOA that the lockdown has made poverty worse, leading parents to impose FGM on their daughters in preparation for forced early marriages.
But of course the challenge which was set in during the lockdown was that markets were closed. So the pastoral communities who would only have their animals sold in the markets had nothing to sell because the markets were closed. So for their survival, they quickly prepared their children, took them into female genital mutilation, and married them off forcefully.
Mutuzo says it is shocking that older women also are increasingly facing the knife amid pressure from the community and their husbands.
Even the elderly women in their middle ages, 45, between 30 and 45, who we think would have already passed the danger of FGM, went back to conduct FGM, that they are being discriminated for cultural and traditional functions, when their sons are being initiated into marriage, when they are being circumcised, the boys, I mean, their mothers who are uncircumcised are not allowed to take part in the function. So their husbands would have to borrow a woman who is circumcised to stand in for the mother who is uncircumcised.
Activists are calling for concerted efforts to sensitize communities about the dangers of FGM and the penalties for violating anti-FGM laws and policies. Jackson Chekweko is the executive director of Reproductive Health Uganda. He says perpetuators of FGM should be reprimanded.
And for as long as the law is in force, it will not discriminate against anybody. It will catch up with anybody. So I'm appealing to the allied community to talk to their people such that they are not found outside the law.
Uganda's law banning FGM calls for 10 years in prison for anyone convicted carrying out FGM or a life sentence for aggravated mutilation. The World Health Organization says FGM involves a partial or total removal of external female genitalia or injuring of any part of the female reproductive system. The practice is internationally recognized as a violation of human rights, health and integrity of girls and women. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Ethiopia has admonished the United States over security warnings. According to the French news agency AFP, government spokesperson Kabede de Sessa told reporters today that the U.S. is spreading false information about security conditions in the war-hit country and warned that such statements could harm ties. Previously, the spokesperson said the U.S. disseminated information that the capital Addis Ababa is surrounded by rebels and now is falsely saying that a terror attack is looming. Washington once viewed Ethiopia as a vital security partner in the volatile Horn of Africa, but relations have soured over Ethiopia's year-long war against rebels who are threatening to march on the capital. On November 5th, the State Department ordered the withdrawal of non-essential embassy staff, citing armed conflict and civil unrest. Other diplomatic missions have followed suit. The Biden administration this month announced its intention to expel Ethiopia from a key trade pact that grants duty-free access for most exports. But it has held off on imposing sanctions against the Ethiopian government and rebels in hopes of encouraging settlement. Quoting a judicial source, the French news agency AFP says, an Egyptian court has sentenced to death 22 Islamist militants, including a police officer. The court found the men guilty of committing 54 terrorist operations across Egypt, including the killing of a senior police officer and an assassination attempt on former Interior Minister Mohamed Ibrahim. The World Food Program says that despite good rains last season, Zimbabwe requires millions of dollars to reduce the threat of food shortages in the country. From Bulawayo, reporter Adi Gando has the story.
Despite plentiful rains, a report by the World Food Program's Rural Vulnerability Assessment Committee indicates that nearly 3 million people in rural areas and 2.5 million people in urban areas continue to be food insecure. The WFP says the resource-poor and food-insecure households are saddled with a wide range of shocks, including climate variability, extreme weather events, conflict, and socioeconomic crises. The agency says US $65 million is required to reduce food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Observers say that talk of a bumper harvest leads many observers to ask why many are said to be struggling to put food on the table. VOA reached out to economic analysts and other commentators for an explanation. Economic analyst Oswald Obina says the efforts by the WFP to raise money for food insecure Zimbabweans spotlights the questioning of the integrity of national statistics, especially compared to information supplied by international development agencies.
More needs to be done to ensure a common dashboard exists between information contained by international organizations and related government agencies. The sustained information asymmetry among these key stakeholders forms the basis of perceived political manipulation of data. Ultimately, international organizations, particularly UN agencies, will appear to be more credible in the eyes of global public opinion. We need to do more to inspire the necessary confidence in our accounting and reporting frameworks as a country, including our internal national communication strategies.
Observers say that traditionally commercial agriculture was a prerogative of white commercial farmers, especially regarding cash crops such as wheat, cotton, and tobacco, while smallholder farmers were returning to the land every season. They say the current land tenure system has disrupted both white commercial farming and incapacitated small landholders. Many cannot secure funding from banks without title. They are forced to wait for government schemes which are not well administered and have been the source of opaque dealings by highly connected individuals. Bina agrees that there is a disparity between resources invested by government into the sector and output in general.
It exposes deep challenges we have in the agrarian sector and the widely shared view on the absence of one government approach to dealing with broad national challenges. Zimbabwe's agrarian sector is not efficient. Whilst we are deploying a greater chunk of the fiscal resources to this sector, we are actually hardly accruing matching agricultural productivity. It then explains the food availability gaps. It is also compounded by, obviously, the land tenure complications which have locked out private money from this sector since land reform. I'm sure more needs to be done to increase both confidence and productivity on the land.
Other analysts accuse authorities of agricultural management through propaganda. Farai Magu of the Center for National Resource Governance maintains that government programs are implemented in a haphazard manner.
This is November. They know very well that our planting season starts in November and it ends towards the end of December. But the command agriculture inputs, they reach the farmers in January, sometimes late January. That's when they are expected to start planting. And as a result, the so-called new farmers who are the beneficiaries of command agriculture end up selling those inputs. They are not farming. They are not plowing. And yet, billions are taken out of the fiscus under the name of Command Agriculture, supporting farmers. So we have to be honest, even when we talk about Command Agriculture, there is a need for an evaluation, an honest evaluation of the program.
On his part, the leader of government business in Parliament, Ziyambi Ziyambi, responded to questions put to him about support for farmers. He said that authorities now expect them to approach banks for loans guaranteed by the government. But analysts say that farmers, especially smallholders, face an uphill battle securing the necessary funding for their operations without title to land, despite assurances. Meanwhile, food insecurity hovers over Zimbabwe like a dark cloud. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Nigeria is still leading in the number of children who are out of school in sub-Saharan Africa. Many educators fear this could affect their psychosocial well-being and development if action is not taken by the government. Munachi Chooks reports.
With over 10 million children out of school in Nigeria, the United Nations says incessant attacks on schools, the abduction of school children, and poverty are threatening the future of the country. Public health specialists like Dr. Laz Eze in Abuja fear this could have severe implications on the mental health and development of children.
Education has a direct correlation to the health of a nation, because the better educated, the more likely people live a healthier life. So when we have over 10 million has been reported out of school children in Nigeria, we are having a generation in future where we have many of the girls and women, not having sufficient knowledge to take care of their babies, going for antenatal care, and also ensuring that they have appropriate nutrition.
Dr. Lars notes that addressing the psychosocial well-being and development of children and teachers in conflict situations is an important part of re-establishing their access to education and establishing a stable future. Educationalist Zainab Abba Haliru tells VOA that the numbers of children who have dropped out of school has become an epidemic in Nigeria.
Nigeria's lead in the world out of school children's index is simply due to our lackluster attitude towards education. Our individual attitudes towards education has gone on to have a negative impact on the way our leaders approach issues bordering on education. Naturally, the result is that as a collective, we lack the capacity to adapt to the new world order that is governed by a knowledge economy. That is where the poverty stems from, and insecurity is an offshoot of the whole situation.
Osman Apaya, a primary school teacher in Mina, Niger State, told VOA that the failure of children to attend classes will endanger the communities they come from.
The situation is going to give the country, the community and the country at large a very, very negative effect. Education is the bedrock of any successful development. So what do you expect when the children who are supposed to be the leader of tomorrow are not being educated?
Schools in northern Nigeria have been targets for mass abductions for ransom by armed groups. So far, there have been 20 attacks on schools in Nigeria this year, with more than 1,400 children abducted and 16 dead. According to UNICEF, more than 200 children are still missing. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.